So in the first part of this course, I talked about the conundrum that victims are ignored by the system. I talked about numbers of victims and impact. I talked about those UN standards and what has happened in many other countries to meet those standards. In the second part, I talked about policing and particularly the importance of police being a link to information and to services for victims as a way of increasing the number of victims of going to the police, but also improving the police response to victims. I talked about services and the need to fund these services on a more universal basis and services that were sensitive to women and children and the disabled and Aboriginals. And I also talked about the importance of restitution from the offender and compensation from the state. So in this last section, I'm going to talk about really three things: the issue of the role of the victim in criminal justice, the way to bring about changes, and some of the follow-up things that you may want to do after listening or engaging in this course. So let's turn to participation. In the second slide, figure 7.2, it talks about the participation and representation of victims in the International Criminal Court. It's a permanent criminal court, which Canada is a very active participant. And what it illustrates is that Canada has already approved an active role for victims in an adversarial process. So the International Criminal Court is a combination of our traditional adversarial process that protects the rights of innocent suspects and of the French system where the victim is represented by a lawyer, often paid out of legal aid. If you actually go and look at the statute setting up that court that dates from the late 1990s or the rules of procedure that came along a little bit later, you will see a very comprehensive combination of legislation, procedure, and action. So from the moment that the victim is engaged because they've decided that there are grounds for a particular case, the victims are protected and supported, including gender support, so support that's sensitive to women. It includes a system of participation and representation paid by legal aid in the trial and sentencing part. It includes potentially restitution, and it has a trust fund that is promoting prevention. And all of these items are supported by the governments that are in there. My point basically is that we should be looking at this and not accepting a view that is often promoted by people who don't want to see rights and services for victims brought up to international standards, who say, well, it can't be done in the adversarial process, it's going to be too emotional, it's going to result in delays. Well, this is just not true, and this is a very concrete example of that. If you look south of the border, you see a very important piece of model legislation called the Justice for All Act. And in my third slide, I've set out the key sections of that Justice for All Act from 2004. It includes things like the victim being reasonably protected, the right not to be excluded from proceedings, the right to be heard, and so on. Not only does it include those seven sections, but it has a procedure whereby if the victim does not receive the right that is in there, that the victim can get a lawyer to help an appeal so that the victim does get that right. Now, this is very different from the Bill of Rights in Ontario that are not really a Bill of Rights. There's some nice principles that somebody agreed, but nobody has actually taken seriously and made sure that they're implemented. Very, very different from the federal, provincial, territorial principles, which are principles that really led to almost nothing. They led to some legislation for services, but no rights with a remedy. Well, the U.S. 2004 legislated this Justice for All Act and set up the funding to ensure that these rights were in fact met. It also got the General Accounting Office to evaluate whether these particular rights were in fact being implemented in the best way possible. This is the sort of legislation that we need everywhere in this country. If in 2004 the U.S. Congress and President could agree to such simple rights, every victim in this country should have those simple rights. For instance, we have provisions for a victim impact statement, but if the judge doesn't follow the criminal code provisions or the victim never heard about the victim impact statement, there is no remedy. We have to have a system with much more extensive rights than the victim impact statement, and we have to have a way of ensuring that those rights can be enforced. Restitution, which I mentioned in the earlier piece, most judges overlook it. They think that the offender can't pay or there's no request or whatever the excuse is. Well, under the federal system in the U.S., those excuses are not acceptable. So this is a great piece of model legislation. In the fifth slide, what I pointed out is, if you like, the theory of what we need a three-way process. Many years ago, we had a federal process for divorce and a provincial process for alimony, and we brought those together into one unified court, and that's really what we need here. The federal criminal justice process is a crown attorney against the suspect. The civil court is a victim against the suspect. We need these combined into one process. We probably need to do this through some experimentation like we did on the Unified Family Court. In slide six, I've set out the conclusions from the chapter about staking claims, and I've mentioned the main issues. We need legal aid for victims. We need surveys to see if they're getting these, and we need to experiment with a court process somewhat similar to that international criminal court. Let's move now to preventing victimization, and I'm going to be quite quick here. The main point about preventing victimization is set out in slide 8. We know today how to reduce street violence, how to reduce violence against women, how to reduce child abuse, how to reduce property crime. We know how to act with partnerships involving policing and so on. We have examples like Winnipeg, where they've reduced car theft by over 80%. And we have many other well-known projects, for instance, the 4th R that reduces violence against women. It's not my purpose here to help you to be an expert in prevention, but simply to know that one of the most important rights for crime victims is good prevention. The province of Alberta has moved further, as you can see in slide 11, than any other province, actually any other jurisdiction in North America, to come out with a balanced approach to prevention. And that's what we need from coast to coast. And we're beginning to get a little bit from municipalities and other provinces, but we need very clearly leadership. So the issue here is we know how to do it, and we need to start doing it. I've set out a section from my website that can give you more information about that, and I've also set out in slide 11 some of the basic principles of effective prevention. So let's move on now to rebalancing justice. How do we rebalance this? Slide 13, I've shown Madam Justice blind to the victims of crime. That's where we're at the moment. And in slide 14, I've set out what I see as the basic inalienable rights, and this is not just me, this is many of the experts working in the victim area. So we need issues relating to support, relating to justice, and we need good government, and good government means more than anything else, implementation. But one of the problems is that we haven't been spending money on this. And this is also true in the United States. Huge amounts of money going into chasing the punitive solution in the United States. Huge amounts of money. An average taxpayer in the United States is paying twice what we are. And it disturbs me that we might go in that direction. I think we have to limit prison capacity to what we have at the moment and get our judges to treat prison capacity as a scarce resource and set priorities on it. This is what we do in healthcare. We've limited the number of beds for healthcare, and we use our doctors to make smart decisions on priorities. We have to do this in the criminal justice area. It's not that we shouldn't punish those who are the most egregious violations or the most dangerous. It's that we need to use a scarce resource to that. And instead of wasting money on additional incarceration for people where it will not provide protection to victims or justice to victims, we need to start investing in the services that I've talked about in the earlier sections. We need to improve compensation, and we need to do the less costly items, but they do have a cost attached to them, to ensure that police are informing victims, to ensure that restitution is ordered, and to give a greater role for the victim in the process so that they can argue for their own safety. Of course, the U.S. does this part through fines on rich offenders, the $1.3 billion fine on FICA. There's no reason why Canada should not be instituting fines for major corporations violating our laws. But I ultimately think if we're going to be paying for services like corrections out of general revenue, we should be paying for services for victims out of general revenue. In slide 16, I've laid out how the money goes in reacting to victims, $12 billion for policing. About two-thirds of that, by the way, goes for the 911 response. And, of course, what we need to do is to reduce the pressure on 911, and the way to do that is through prevention. But if we can afford this amount of money to react to crime without doing the things that are clearly stated internationally for victims and are being done in the European Union countries and in Japan, we need to start putting money where it's needed for victims of crime. In slide 17, it's quite a complicated table, but I've laid out where the main new money would be needed, and I'll let you look at that at your ease. But basically, the items that are expensive are ensuring adequate services for victims, adequate assistance for victims, and ensuring proper compensation. Most of the other things for victims can be done for a relatively small proportion. Slide 18 includes an initial vision or dream for what might be an amendment to our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. I think we could look at the American proposals that are largely embodied in the Justice for All Act and are now being reproposed for a constitutional amendment this year by Congress. But the one that I think makes the most sense to get us thinking is this. We need a balance between the rights for victims of crime and rights for offenders. We do not need a situation where whatever the concern for offenders and suspects automatically trumps basic rights for victims of crime. Basic rights for victims of crime, in my book, are right to safety. This means not to be in a bail hearing, to be able to argue for safety. the parole hearing or sentence hearing, anywhere where release of the offender is being discussed. Victim needs to be able to argue their concerns or their perceived concerns and be able to get an answer from the judge that those concerns have been understood and considered. Right to reparation, that's basically the right to restitution, needs to be there every time the state intervenes with a suspect or offender. The issue of restitution needs to be protected. The third issue is justice, and I'm not totally clear what is meant by justice, but it's certainly some feeling of fairness, of some proportionality, and I think it means different things to different victim groups. Some of the victims of extreme violence occurred to family members. One group has been arguing for tougher penalties. Another group has been arguing for restorative justice. So justice, it covers a very broad range, but often it has to do with the procedure. So those would be my three basic rights. And some of these overlap with the detail, the important detail in the Justice for All Act in the United States. Now, these have to be balanced fairly against the rights of the accused or convicted offender that are set out in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. What I want to see is I want to see judges being asked to balance those rights that I want to see enshrined for victims in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms with those already enshrined for the accused and the offender, and through a process where representation for the victim is equal to that of the accused. So the victim would have a lawyer and standing and legal aid and so on. Now, I would like to see this discussed and debated, and it's possible that we could see an interim step with some legislation that was passed federally and provincially, but ultimately I think we have to face the need to change the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Now, in the book, I've included model legislation that does not really include this possible amendment, but that legislation could be enacted without necessarily an immediate change to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So the conclusion so far from these three sections is to come back to my initial proposal. We need a federal and provincial action plan. Need to get standards like are available across the European Union and like the law that is in my book, Rights for Victims of Crime. This has to change the way policing is going about, not necessarily a radical or costly change. We need services. We need better services. We need restitution. We need compensation. We need a role for the victim in the prosecution and courts. We need to make sure that it's sensitive to the needs of women and children, the disabled and Aboriginal, and we need real ways to get this stuff implemented. Even with that, we need to have an advocate like the advocate in South Australia or like the advocate that's been recommended by the McMurtry Task Force in Ontario. We need regular surveys. Surveys, these have been recommended by the chiefs of police in the US. We need a permanent institute to develop things better in our country. We need firm prevention policies, and we need permanent funding for prevention, for services, for rights. And in my view, we need an amendment to the charter. Now, let me just mention a few other things in concluding. The small organization that I'm president of has brought together some of the most experienced people working on services and rights for victims, and you can see more about it there. There is also the World Society of Victimology that I'm sure other folk are talking to you about. I've been president of that. IOVA is much more practically oriented and wants to deliver services in third world countries based on our knowledge about those. The two books that I've written for legislators, Rights for Victims of Crime is the one most immediately relevant for this course, but Less Law, More Order has also influenced a lot of prevention policies in this country and in other countries. In slide 22, this slide for What Have You Done for Justice Today, I hope this small contribution to this e-course has inspired you to get active, to try and influence policy, and to try and get our services, our law enforcement, very professional law enforcement, our lawyers, and so on, to understand the needs of victims and to be open to innovation and to a different way of thinking and acting for victims of crime. My last slide simply says that if you want to stay involved, there are a couple of ways that you can do this. I have a listserv with over 1,000 people that goes out from time to time. When I hear of a new good practice or a new development relating to crime victims and crime reduction in Canada, and it's strictly oriented to the Canadian situation. You can also follow me either on my website or on Twitter in relation to what's happening internationally. I put a blog about once a month, and I would very much encourage you to get involved with Twitter. What we need is a shift in the way of thinking. And I think Twitter has shown, and social media have shown, that we can get major shifts in thinking. The way that we are responding to preventing victimization and creating the services and rights, nothing is more urgently needed than a shift in thinking and action to bring Canada up to the international standards that date from more than 25 years ago, but also bringing Canada up to the standards that many U.S. jurisdictions from coast to coast in the European Union, Japan, and states like South Australia and Australia have demonstrated is feasible, affordable, and makes the difference that we need for crime victims.